Evening, folks. You are listening to Gangland Wire, and we love this podcast in Scotland.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, hello, all you wiretappers out there in wiretapper land. We're back here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City, with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, we're back again for episode two, or part two, of our show on kind of the drug man. I believe there's a movie that's going to be, a documentary movie that's going to be coming out called, God, is it The Drug Man? Do you know?
Something like that.
There's a documentary that's going to be coming out by my good friend Seth Ferrante and Scott Bernstein is also part of it. We recently had an episode with or an interview of Scott Bernstein about it's titled The Drug Man, and it's about the formation of the first narcotic syndicates in the United States, how that all came about. And so, as you know, in our last episode with our good friend Bill Owsley, he talked about how the laws, the legal system developed to create a framework to prohibit narcotics and the framework to then enforce those narcotics laws in an attempt, probably a futile attempt if history tells us anything, of controlling and maybe eliminating illegal narcotics traffic. So welcome, Bill, and good to have you back here tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, we ended up kind of with Harry Anslinger and the Federal Bureau of the Narcotics, and you mentioned that they were really the first ones that identified that there was a Sicilian-based tie-in organized crime entities in the United States and really internationally because of their work overseas. I believe you said that his first efforts, since they don't make opium poppies in the United States, we don't seem to grow them here. I don't know. Do you think is the climate not good for them or what? I've never figured that one out. They grow a lot of marijuana over here.
I got a farm. I might try it.
There you go. Well, probably better not. But
that's why they dipped in prohibition. Alcohol is so much easier.
It is a lot easier. Yes, all you have to have is some grapes and sugar, and let it ferment, and then pour it up in the bottle. Hey, you know, Bill. A little aside here. I don't know if you know this. There's a lady got hold of me, and she said she had seen my app, looking around at the mob sites in Kansas City, and she said, well, my grandpa lives in the house down here on Gillison, and he has a tunnel in the basement, and he has a room where they used to store the wine. He has a big vat that was built in the basement just to make wine back during Prohibition. I said, really? I said, well, I'd like to see that. And she said, okay, meet me down there. So I met her down there that night, and we go into her grandpa's house. It's like, it's on my app. I didn't put the exact address. It's in the 500 block of Gillis, one of those brick apartments down there, or brick kind of, what do you call those?
Shirtwaist houses?
Not shirtwaist. It's like a building, but it has separate entrances, and there's two stories, and there's a basement under. So we go down in the basement, and her grandpa was in there, and he's a little bit around the bend, but he didn't really know why we were there. So we go down the basement, and there's this marble vat built in the basement down there. It didn't have, I noticed what is interesting, it didn't have a drain plug in the bottom of it. So I guess they put the grapes in there and mashed them up and let them ferment with the sugar and everything, and then dipped it out and strained it. And then the room next to it, she said that he used to tell her when she was a little girl that there was shelves on that wall there, and they would store the gallon jugs of homemade wine there during Prohibition.
Yeah.
But then we're looking for the tunnels. And she goes over and she says, I know there was a tunnel here. I know there was. I remember it when I was a little girl. And she's pounding on the wall, and her husband's there, and we're poking around on the wall. We can't find it. So we go back upstairs, and she asks her grandpa, and again, he's not sure. I can tell he's kind of not sure, but it's like he doesn't. I got the feeling he really didn't want to say anything. You know what I mean? It was like it was still in his mind. It was still sure. A secret. And
you might be part of the law enforcement,
right? Oh yeah, I was. So I walk out the front. We walk out the front door, and we're just kind of looking, and between the front stoop and the sidewalk, there is a set of stairs that goes down into kind of a just a little hole almost between the front of the building and the sidewalk. It's only about 3 feet wide and about 6 feet long. And there's a set of stairs. And she says, oh, I remember. So come down here. So we go down those stairs, and there is a tunnel that goes underneath Gillis across the street. And she said that his brother lived across the street, and that's where they would then take the wine. They'd have to go out the front door, down those stairs, but into this tunnel across the street, and then take it up into the brother's house and hold it there. And then eventually somebody would come along and take it somewhere. So it was a really interesting little trip back into 1920s, 1930s Kansas City. So anyhow, that was a little aside, folks. We're going to talk about the narcotic syndicate in Kansas City as an example. We got you up to, you know, creating this organization to fight these narcotics organizations, and they were developed with international connections and trade routes from Turkey to Sicily to maybe France, Canada to the United States. I believe that's where the French connection kind of was. Part of their operation was through Canada, but part of it was directly from Marseille into the port in New York City. And so, but Kansas City had a big piece of that. So, Bill, let's talk a little bit about, you know, Harry Anslinger and the early narcotics bureau and fighting, you know, these specific mafia gangs here in Kansas City.
Anslinger is director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, is going after the trade routes. Of course, they got narcotics agents in the various cities. They're establishing what's going on abroad. And at the same time, the Italian-Sicilian group, which is organized into what we call Cosa Nostra, they're dipping their fingers into the drugs and making it a major operation. Anslinger's organization is truly the only one. I mean, some local police departments were involved, certainly, but on a federal basis, they were the mainstay. So while he's in working, the mob is working, you know. And Anslinger's job is getting harder as they get better. What happened in Kansas City is our organization that consolidated during Prohibition, seeing the end of Prohibition, the powers to be decide that losing alcohol, they would replace it by going big time into a drug operation. And it was called the Kansas City Narcotics Syndicate. Our narcotics agent here, who was instrumental in breaking it up, he had another name for it, I forget right now, but it was like a subsidiary of the mob, which is what it was. They appointed one of the original founders of the organization, a guy named Joe DeLuca, and he was given the job of putting this together, he and his brother, Frank. They put it together on a business basis. This wasn't going to be just supplying a few little people here or there or supplying Kansas City's drug pool. No, this was going to be as big as they could possibly make it. So they had managers, supervisors, legal people, bookkeepers, salespeople, other representatives. They had the whole thing. They had the whole ball of wax put together as you would a business organization. They established their trade routes. where they would get the drugs from. Their drugs were coming from Sicily, right? The opium deal in the Orient, which was the original main supplier, that sort of dried up, at least in the sense of what the mob was doing. I think because they had greater contacts with the French and the Italian mafia in Sicily. They've established their trade routes, and very skeletonly, I will mention, what they did, they had supervisors looking after local salespeople who were making drug sales. They had a courier who went to Tampa. The drugs that were coming in through the French connection and the Italians in Sicily, coming in to Cuba. Cuba had a go-between, a Cuban politico, who was also a internationally known drug dealer. The drugs went from him to the Antonori brothers in Tampa. Our courier would go down to Tampa, bring the drugs back. They would be distributed to our salespeople, and they were covering all of the states adjacent to us, plus California, and wherever they could establish a contact. That was the skeleton of the narcotics industry. And later, Anslinger identified it as one of the earliest large-scale, truly organized narcotic syndicate in the United States.
Interesting. You know, I'm looking through your book here, and one of the early stories here, everything's old is new again, about this car chase in 1923. Yet two well-dressed young men speeding wildly up and down the streets in a high-powered car caught the attention of the police with a little, not car chase, but an investigation followed to see who they were, did a little surveillance on them, and they ended up forcing their way into a residence that they caught them at, or they got in it and found four new car tires there. And so they brought the tires in, and they thought they were stolen. And they also found a suitcase there, which when they opened it up, it had a large quantity of morphine, cocaine, and opium, value of $3,500. So they just stumbled onto one of the first big drug busts in Kansas City by accident. It sounds like you think that was all by accident.
No, actually, you're describing the beginning of a narcotics investigation. As we well know, working organized crime, you develop intelligence. You take one thing that happened, hope to connect it with something else, and this guy belongs to him, and what have you. So what happened is when they arrested Tony Gizzo, who was the driver of the car and would one day be the Kansas City mob boss. And I might mention, even though preceding the syndicate, many of these guys were dealing drugs, but not on this basis. It wasn't new to them. The narcotics agents were making buys. As I said, last episode, they were the first to work undercover, make buys, develop informants, and work off of intelligence develop a scheme of things. Gradually, they're making buys here. They don't know that this is part of this national syndicate. Not in the beginning. But soon, as it happens, A becomes connected to B, B becomes connected to C, this guy belongs to that. They seize a suitcase that belongs to Pete DiGiovanni, one of the big guys in the back, who are running things through Joe DeLuca. So now is a connection to the mob hierarchy. And then two things happened. They got a tip about the name Nicola, and that's all they knew, connected to drugs. Well, Nick Impastato was the on-the-street CEO. But they didn't know who he was. They didn't know what this meant. But it was in the back of their head. So that was one thing. The second thing that happened is in 39, a guy by the name of Nicola Gentile, he was a fascinating character in his own right. He became one of the other large narcotic syndicate, and he had ties to Kansas City. They were operating mainly in the South. So he and his partner come up to Kansas City, and they try to sell their drugs to Kansas City. Kansas City says, you know what? We don't need your drugs. You know, we're bigger than that. But if you want to buy anything we have left over, we'll be happy to sell you. So they say, good, we'll do that. They go home. The same year, Gentile is arrested, and in his dress book is the name Nicole Impastato. Now there's another connection. This is a big deal. Who's this Impastato? Little by little, they're putting this together. Then they see the big picture, and they go from there. And I might mention, because before I let you see where you want to go with this, a fellow by the name of Caramusa had taken over as the drug carrier, courier. Once the indictments were brought down, which they were, Caramusa turned state's evidence, became a cooperating witness. That was a huge break for the narcotics people. And so they convicted 13 or 14 people. That little vignette with the Gizzo guy in a car connected with a lot of undercover buys, and the dots were connected, and it exposed a sophisticated, well-organized, one seizure on today's market would have been over $500,000. That was just one suitcase in one house. I think the figure of some $12 million a year in 1940.
Wow, that was a lot of money in 1940. And so Caramusa, now he was going to Tampa and picking up loads of heroin and bringing them back up to Kansas City.
Right. That was the route they established. They had some other connections, but the primary one was through the Antonoris. They were indicted, by the way, in the case. And later, the main Antonori brother was murdered. There were four people in this case that were murdered, which is also interesting, including Caramusa.
Was he? And there is a side story about Caramusa and the intimidation of him. And I remembered that name from back in the old days before that and what happened. So why don't you tell folks that side story?
Well, there are two things that happened with Caramusa. First, his 12-year-old brother, back in the early days of the Black Hand, riding on a pushcart with his father, this Black Hander shotgunned the little boy to death. It was a major thing. But there again, the fear of the Black Hand, no one came forward. The police knew who did it and went after him, but he, as it happened, escaped. So this Caramusa may have had that in his mind when he decided, I'm going to cooperate. The fellow who they believe killed him was a guy named Cantanzaro. So when the trial is going on, they call Caramusa to the witness, and you who've seen The Godfather will see this replayed in The Godfather. Yes. They bring this Cantanzaro into the courtroom, and Caramusa knows that this is the guy that killed his brother. And they sit him right in the front row, and through hand signals and glaring, and he went into the whole routine to intimidate Caramusa. This was right out of the Sicilian Mafia book from Sicily. Finally, it got to the point that they had to eject him from the courthouse.
Wow. So you say Caramusa ended up getting killed in the end?
Caramusa, there was no witness protection then. And so Caramusa moved to Chicago.
Yeah, they had a program of get out of town.
Yeah, that's about it. He changed his name and went to Chicago, was running a business up there and all that. And one day he spots this car and he knows that he's being stalked. he's trying desperately to get a hold of Claude Fulmer, the narcotics agent here. Fulmer can't get to him in time, and he's shotgunned to death, leaving his residence in front of his daughters. They caught up with him. They think that the shooters were from Tampa.
Talk a little bit more about this Nikolai Gentile, or Gentile.
Yeah.
He was. What was his base? Was it New Orleans? Was he connected with the family down in New Orleans?
Well, I outline in the book, if anybody's interested in this character, he had a big play in Kansas City. It's one of the first stops when he emigrated here. He, and it's a funny story, he ending up in Kansas City from a little nowhere place in Sicily. The buildings and the people, and he was overcome with the place. He had nobody to talk to. He didn't know anybody, or he did know one person, his brother, but his brother wasn't there. He was working in Topeka. So Gentile had connections here, and he graduated and was considered the traveling emissary of the fledgling mafia here. He would travel around and troubleshoot. He would travel around and negotiate disputes. He would be connected to this family. He'd be connected to that family. He'd come back to Kansas City, worked for the mob. So he became like a national figure in the burgeoning early Cosa Nostra. And what happened in his life, he eventually, due to financial problems and what have you, was hooked up with this major drug operator. They formed a partnership, and they were operating out of New Orleans. This was towards the end of his career. And when he was arrested, he was then deported. And but his blue book, his black book, was an important link to the Kansas City Narcotics Syndicate. And he came up here because of his earlier ties and knowledge of these people.
Interesting. You never know how it works and how people make one connection, and then later on it comes back to, then it makes everything understandable once you learn about that earlier connection. So you got to study the history of organized crime in order to know what's going on today. I learned that a long time ago.
Well, it's so complex and so interrelated, there are family ties, there are old country ties. There's intercity ties. It's funny how, you know, one city will have strong ties in some cities and none in another. Mainly because as the investigations came about and law enforcement became involved after the Apalachin meeting, these guys couldn't just all get together. And it's not like a big cookout where the families get together. Oh, Kansas City's having a cookout with Chicago, and we all know each other. So, but there are always ties somewhere. And if they don't know someone in Chicago, they know someone in St. Louis who knows someone in Chicago.
Well, I actually do stuff like that myself today.
Sure.
It's human nature, I guess, isn't it?
Networking.
Networking, yeah, exactly. Good word. I couldn't think of the word. Good word, networking.
Yeah.
So as we move on up into World War II, things kind of usually go down on, not maybe the down low, but it gets really hard to do these kinds of things during World War II. The whole world was caught up in that. Kind of what happened? What was the progression of the Kansas City Narcotics Syndicate on into the war and after the war in the early 50s?
For all intents purposes, and for whatever reasons, the powers to be that ran the mob here, it appears that with the takedown of the Narcotics Syndicate, sending these people to jail. They deported two people. That Impastato was deported, and another guy, Simone Simone, who was one of the couriers before Caramusa, deported. Joe DeLuca sentenced to jail, and they attempted to deport him, but he beat that case on a technicality. It appears that the effect of that was to squash any thoughts of reviving this or staying in narcotics on a major basis. Because I know during my time and your time, that was not one of their menus, on their menu, and I could not find anything indicating that after the 1940 indictments and prosecutions, that any attempt was made to deal on this scale.
Interesting. I guess I didn't really realize that. But like you said, during my time, I never heard of it. Only people on the periphery were involved, but never anybody who was anybody was.
No.
Never was anything connected. Now, Junior Bradley was on the periphery, and he really was heavily involved in his own way. But
well, you know, there's a story, and I think most of it is legend. The part of the story is true. The impact, I don't know about. But Tony Gizzo, that guy in the cattle in the yellow sports car, becomes the boss in 1950. He brings Nick Civella in as his number one man. Nick had fled to Chicago because they had been trying to kill him. Now he's been rehabbed. Gizzo's son, Robert, was a dead bang addict and was no end of problem to Gizzo. It was well known what the narcotics had done to this kid. And so the legend is Nick being a close associate, having had contact with Robert probably, maybe trying to put out a fire for Gizzo. He supposedly used that as a signal that this is not good stuff. I think combined with that is some of the draconian sentences that were coming out of the Harrison Act in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But for whatever reason, it appears, and I think we can attest to that, that Nick was not going to dabble directly as a family operation in drugs.
Interesting. Yeah, but you know, on a national basis, now I don't remember any of my readings or study indicating that Chicago, the outfit, did much in this area after the war. New York and particularly the people that got involved in the French Connection in the end, and the Bonanno family and the Gambino family both, when John Gotti took it over, they were all heavily involved in this whole French Connection thing. We did a story on the French Connection, and they were heavily involved in that. Carmine Galante was in jail or just got put in jail about that time, and he was, you know, he'd been the underboss, mm-hmm. and he got a 20-year sentence about 1960 or 61. So for some reason, it was a little bit different back in New York because they did not. They continued as a mob family, La Cosa Nostra family. Both those families continued to be involved in the importation of a major importation of narcotics.
Well, that's true. And what's funny about that is that they put out the word that we don't do drugs, the bosses, you know, but elements and parts of the family did it, and they don't ask, don't tell. And they were heavily involved, as you say. Galante was known as the drug king. That was his thing, was drugs. And they were hoping to revive even a bigger drug cartel when he was shotgunned in a restaurant and killed by these guys they called the Zips. These were Sicilian mafia guys sent over here to operate on our soil doing drug cartels and to associate themselves where they could with the crime families. I don't know about Chicago and drugs. I haven't really looked into it. I'd be surprised if they didn't do any, but I don't think they're noted for it. Others who know Chicago would know more. There's no question that Cosa Nostra was heavily involved in drugs and the importation of just every form of drug you could marijuana and whatever it was. They had a habit of also turning these things over and gaining the benefit and not any of the risk. For example, you know, motorcycle gangs were associated with some mob families, and they got their drugs from them. They did all the work and cut the mob in. In some of the black neighborhoods, they went to the resident black gang leader and formed relationships. So they were at it full scale.
Exactly, and even in Kansas City, is our own Junior Bradley. He formed a relationship with one of the black kingpins of Kansas City, Terry Kelton. While he was in the joint when this was going on. Junior always had connections with people in the joint.
Yeah,
you ever notice that?
Yeah, oh,
he had this immense network within the federal penitentiary system. And he was supplying the money, and Kelton had all these contacts out here and had been involved with a heroin operation, was turned into a cocaine operation into the 70s, and then he would put that money out in the street, so to speak, and they'd go buy the drugs and make the money, and then Junior would get a big piece of that back, and Kelton would.
Yeah.
He was so heavily involved with them, he even participated. Kelton wanted to have, I believe, his wife killed. And Bradley even participated in that, kind of trying to set up a hit on his wife because I think she was going to testify or something. I don't have all the details.
Yeah.
But you may remember that. I don't remember if you were still here. Were you retired by then?
That happened. Yeah. Well, you know, we also had one of our guys who we believe he was a Shylock, and we believe that what he was doing was lending money to some of the people. And, you know, he could go, his answer was, I didn't know what they were doing with it. Everybody had, you know, but one other indicator to me that the Savella's mob wasn't involved, there would have been no other people if they were. There would have been no Keltons, not the Jamaicans. I don't know if the Bloods came here, but the Jamaicans were heavy. Those guys would have been suppressed. And they were a lot, you know, to Nick, it was leave it there.
Right.
We don't want it.
Yeah, I think Bradley was just, it was a way for him to make money.
Right, and if it had gotten
and like you say, he was loaning him money to do probably at loan shark rates or then some.
Right, and if he had gotten too far involved and it made a wave for Nick, they would have killed him.
He would have been gone, you know. Yeah.
Well, they had a pretty steady stream of income coming in from Vegas as well, right?
Yeah, that's another thing about our family. We had a huge amount of money coming in from Las Vegas all along. So.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Why get into something like that that's dangerous, right, that you might get busted on?
Well, you know, there's one other item that I see in that protocol or in that dynamic is Kansas City is like a big village.
Yeah.
And the Italian community is even more tighter knit. And I believe that it was Nick's feeling that they would be ostracized, they would lose any support, a politician would not want to be backed by somebody that was dealing drugs. And it was important for him, as you know, all of us who worked organized crime, interviewing people in that community, they didn't know anything about. There's no mafia here. We don't know. We don't know anything about that. Never happened. How about this? No. How about this politician who's doing it? He's a good guy.
He's a good guy.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
I've heard that. I don't know how many times. He's a good guy.
Yeah. Now, if it had been the other way, and the church people, the priest and all this is saying our kids are becoming addicted through it, it would have ruined, I mean, it would have been a big issue for Nick in this small community.
Yeah, because it is small.
Yep.
In that world especially. I mean, I play golf with a really good guy whose sister was the gal that bought that gun that Cork ended up with. I won't mention any names, but I know you know the deal.
Yeah.
And he's a good guy, and he's square John as anything. And, you know, who knows, you know. I mean, it's such a small world in Kansas City.
Sure, yeah, well, they've supported him, and not supported them in that way, but supported him in the sense, it wasn't like a direct support, but an indirectly
yeah.
By ignoring it, by denying it, by not ostracizing these people. That was important to Nick.
Yeah. Well, this has been interesting, fascinating.
I mean, by looking the other, just simply by looking the other way, some of these lower level guys might be running a pretty substantial drug operation. Well, but were they kicking up?
Well, as long as they weren't selling in their community, in the
Italian
American community.
And you know, that's a good question. As far as kicking up, they wouldn't do that. What they would do, maybe they would borrow money and pay exorbitant rates when they paid it back, but it would never be couched in those terms of, I'm doing this for you, and so here, I'm kicking back up to you. This is a piece of my action that you're getting because you're my guy. It would never be couched in those terms. It would only be couched in terms of a loan shark kind of a loan, in which you made me a loan. I don't know. He didn't know what I'm doing with it, and I'm going to pay him. He lends me $50,000. I'm going to give him back $75,000 here in about a month or less. So that's how that would work in Kansas City.
One final item is indicative of what happened to Cosa Nostra totally. When the traditions were ignored, the new breed came in. These weren't true Cosa Nostra people. Greed, power, and all. At the end of, while I was retired, many of the cases that started to come to the federal courthouse were some of, in fact, if you remember, Cork's son, Tony Savella's son
yeah, his nephew,
was indicted and involved in distribution.
Right.
Then the Basta group, there were drug people,
some of them were.
That's the generational change. If things had continued on, we may have seen a drug organization, because they didn't believe in any of this business of being careful, keeping a good profile. The youth, what ruined Cosa Nostra.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, our guys actually worked that case on that young Ripes kid. He was just a dumbass, two-bit, kind of hanging out in the disco bar scene, selling little bits of cocaine.
The progression or the degression of the mob, what I saw one day, and I said, look at this. I remember when they all had suits and ties. They were businessmen like everybody else, and even when the ties went out, they were well-dressed. I remember when it was the leather jacket era. They all had leather jacket and Sansibel slacks.
And polo shirts and leather jackets,
Yeah, but they looked good. Nick didn't allow beards or mustaches. Then there was a thing in one of the magazines of John Gotti Jr. and his followers. He had a wife beater T-shirt on. He had muscles coming out of his ears, and he had Bermuda shorts that looked like they came from the Caribbean, and this was the mob boss.
Yes.
I said, it's over.
Really? And all the rest had more tracksuits with big gold chains around their neck.
That was one of the progressions from the into the tracksuits. Then it was into this.
The
I don't know.
Beaters.
I don't know what that life, what that style is called.
Really, well, this has been fun. This has been illuminating and enlightening about the history of the narcotics investigation and narcotics law and how we got to where we are.
And Bill Elmsley, if nothing else, brought their dress style down.
he brought their dress style down. Look at those young guys out here. All right, you got any more questions, Aaron?
Do you have any other books coming out?
No, not me. I don't have right now. I don't have anything on the hopper. I have trouble with my vocabulary, much less write a book.
Really, folks, it's
well, that seems
a book,
hard to believe.
You think
get Bill going, and he just keeps talking about stuff. It's so amazing.
If we could just record him and then just run that through a translator.
Yeah,
and
just transcription.
Transcription, and just type it out, and you'd have another book.
There
you go.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe a short story.
A short story, yeah. All right. Well, if you folks have a problem with drugs or alcohol, have a friend with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gang Land Wire, available on Amazon for purchase or rent, but you want to own that because you want to go back and watch that over and over again. And then, of course, you want to get Bill Owsley's book, Open City, as well as Mobsters in Our Midst, two great books on the Kansas City mob history.
Really, and I'll have links to them on my on the show notes and on my website. And oh, by the way, you know something we forgot to talk about tonight or mention is the Amazon banner ad, the click on the gun on my podcast blog site pages and buy your stuff that you need to buy from Amazon through that connection there. We will get the podcast, we'll get a little piece of that action.
Yeah, we'll get a little action off of that if you click and buy anything at all. Right. Bill's book, Gary's book, which of course is Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And while you're clicking, you want to click on two things. The Kindle version of the book, Leaving Vegas, because it's got the book itself is transcribed, as well as there is hyperlinks to video with the actual audio from the mouth of the men that did it. And then you want to click on again and get the app, Kansas City Mob Tours. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
All right. Well, Bill, it's been great having you here tonight. Thanks a lot for helping us out with this story.
I enjoyed it very much, and thank you for having me. All
thank right. you.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.